Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ciao e benvenuto al Ruler podcast numero 62, circa il Giro d'Italia. Hello and welcome to the Ruler podcast. I'm Ian Parkinson and this is a special Giro-themed edition. If early spring is the time that cycling fans turn their thoughts to Belgium and northern France, by the beginning of May we are all like Dave Stoller in Breaking Away, a little bit Italian. Well, later on we're going to be joined by a very special guest, and also here is the Ruler editor Ian Cleverley. Ian, what's in edition 62? What are the highlights?
Oh, what are the highlights? Mario Cipollini, for starters.
It's a fabulous interview with Cipollini and some great pictures.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's a good excuse just to sort of rifle through the archives and get some classic Cipo stuff out. Marco's done a great job on it, Marco Pastanesi. I think he's somebody that Cipollini kind of trusted to do a good job with it, and so therefore told him stuff that I certainly hadn't heard about before.
There's all the sort of backstories of his fancy costumes and his special kit as well, wasn't there?
Yeah, but it's almost, the thing is that all that stuff is so crazy that you almost forget what a prolific winner he was, and he was a phenomenal sprinter for an inordinately long time.
Yeah,
he was still winning, you know, into his mid 30s and beyond, which was just pretty mind-blowing. Yeah.
And you always got the sense with him that actually he knew exactly what he was doing in terms of his image. There was a sense that he set out to create that image and he knew exactly how valuable that was.
Totally. And he would milk it and to the nth degree and get fined. I mean, just how hilarious is that? It's like you've got a kind of, you know, superstar rider just like giving you great publicity, and then you give them a fine for not wearing the regulation stuff.
Or for turning up, yeah.
Yeah, as if he gave a flying hoot, you know. Right, really.
I had the luck to meet Cipollini at the Ruler Classic, and I said at the end of it, we miss you in cycling. I think we do.
Yeah, I mean, I guess as Museo said on the last podcast, you know, I won't do an impersonation of Johan's voice, but you know, he loves Sagan because he's rock and roll, and yeah, Cipollini's the same.
Cipollini
deal.
Was definitely,
you know,
rock and roll.
He's a showman.
One of the things about the Giro is that they do throw in some eccentric stages just to keep the crowds amused and just to keep the publicity going, don't they?
Some absolutely insane stuff. I mean, we've got Paul Maunder's done a lovely piece on some of the craziest stages over the years. That's followed by Paolo Cibosa's photo essay on the Finestra, which is a party beyond belief up a goat track. But some of the stuff they've done previously includes going across the Grand Canal in Venice on a specially built pontoon bridge and finishing in San Marco Square. That is imagination. That is awesome.
And keep listening, because that will be part of our Ruler competition later on in this podcast. So probably time for our special guest. Just as our Classics edition featured the Lion of Flanders, Johan Mazea, for this edition we're joined by a winner of the Giro d'Italia and much more, of course, including the Tour de France and the World Championship in the same memorable year. It could only be, well, Phil Liggett probably summed it up best in 1987.
And just who is that rider coming up behind? Because that looks like Roach. That looks like Stephen Roach. It's Stephen Roach who's come over the line. He almost caught Pedro Delgado. I don't believe it.
It looks like Roach. It is Stephen Roach.
How many times a week do people say that to you?
It's actually amazing that, that commentary from Phil Liggett, how it stands out in everyone's mind when they think about the stage of Tour de France up to La Plagne. And, you know, people will first of all say, oh, Stephen, remember that great stage where you collapsed? And Liggett's words, you know? And here we go again.
Do you mind that?
Not at all. Like, you know, I always ask myself to say the question the other way around, you know, saying if nobody ever mentioned it, would I be happy? So the fact that people mention it, it's obviously marked in people's minds. And like 30 years, almost 30 years on now, we're still talking about it. And whether it's because of Liggett's words were so great, whether it was because my my achievement was great, I don't know. But both together, it was a great achievement, yeah.
I think part of it, looking back, especially if you were a cycling fan in the UK, was that it was so rare to see cycling on television. And then, you know, that was in the early stages of Channel 4 broadcasting every evening. So it was a huge event. And it was one of the things that you know, cycling fans talked about the next day and for days afterwards.
Yeah, I think it was also the fact that, the Tour de France and the big tours were all they were all owned by the Belgians, the French, and Italians, and the Spanish. And all of a sudden, we have Tom Simpson and Barry Hobbins, and we had the Chaliots and everything else before. And then all of a sudden, here we have we had Graeme Jones, Paul Sherwin getting some good results. Then all of a sudden, then we have myself, Sean Kelly, Robert Miller, actually doing really, really well. So it was a big turnaround, I think, and people started looking to the Tour de France a little bit more, and people then really realised how important and how monumental the Tour de France and the big tours were, and to have someone from our own side of the water doing so well, it created even more interest and maybe open the doors to other people to say, well, maybe, you know, maybe we can do it, you know.
You had a long, successful career as a professional bike rider, but probably most people will remember you for that summer of 1987, the Tour, the World Championships, and, of course, one of the most controversial Giros of history. Looking back, what are your memories of the 1987 Giro?
Well, I saw the Pope at the end of it all, and he, you know, he kind of gave me a full pardon, you know, but got a private audience with the Pope, and he gave me a full pardon, you know, but I don't know what he'd give me a pardon for, because in my opinion, I did nothing wrong, you know, but there's a couple of 100,000 Italians out there think that I did attack Visentini, you know, whereas, you know, this, you know, let's put the record straight, I didn't actually attack him, I just went down a hill faster than him, and he couldn't follow me, so, you know, it wasn't really attacking, you know, I would never attack a teammate, you know. When you look at it, I was just being an ideal, exemplary teammate. Like, we were leading the Tour of Italy with Visentini. There was three guys in front, no Carrera guy in front. So I just thought, well, yeah, you know, if I get in the front, it means my team haven't got to ride towards the end. The Bianchis will ride for Argentine, the Panasonics for Brooking. So, ideal situation. And, you know, looking at it on the other side, it could have been a bit suicidal as well, because the fact that I finished up the final hill up to Zapata, if I had actually blown my brains, I could have lost everything. Whereas in fact, you know, I prepared to gamble, and what really kind of sparked the whole thing off was when my team car came up and told me that Visentini was riding behind me, where that was the error, not me riding in the front. It was Visentini.
Your
riding.
Own team, the Carrera team, were actually chasing you, yeah. Weren't they? They were trying to chase you down.
Yeah. So, and then when I said, like, tell the guy to stop, I mean, it's let them wait for a few minutes. There's the Bianchis and everybody else, they'll ride. And the answer was, no. Roberto's riding behind, riding. I said, well, you know, he can't ride behind me, you know? So he said, well, you know, you better stop. So I said, well, you just tell Roberto, if he keeps riding, to keep something under the pedal, because when he catches me, he's going to need it, because I'm going to go again.
I think it's fair to say that even now, I think Roberto Visentini doesn't see things that way, does he?
Yeah, you know, and you know, surprisingly, I met him in 1988 on the Giro or something afterwards, and there was no real, didn't feel really any animosity. But in 2013, we had Carrera had a reunion with all the team, and some journalists, and a journalist said to me, Stephen, I haven't seen Roberto. Was he invited? Well, yeah, I think it was. Oh, let's call him. So he called Roberto, and he had to hold the phone about a meter away from his ear. I could hear Roberto shouting into the room, yes, after what those guys did to me, how can they invite me? How can they expect me to come, you know? I said, oh, gosh, you know, 25 years on, he's still crying about it. But, okay, they're having another one now next year for 30 years on, and they want to have all the riders and all the staff back together again, and we'll just see if Roberto shows up, so to be continued.
Looking forward to that.
Watch this space.
We often talk about the passion of the Italian fans, you know, the passion of the Tifosi. You saw the sort of dark side of that, really, in, especially in the couple of days after that stage to Sappada, didn't you?
Yes, but it's still a passion, you know, because they were so passionate about the whole thing and so patriotic, like they, one of their own had been hurt and there was no consoling them. Like even like David Boifava, the team manager, who lived in Brescia, who was a personal friend of Vicentini. The following day, he was on a hill driving up the car with the bikes in the car. And because of the crowds and the roads, the car stalled. And some guy took the bike off the car and said, "Hey, David, you want the bike? Come and get it." Kept going. You know, even one of their own, you know. But they were very passionate about it. And I think the passion they have kind of is one of the real reasons why they changed towards me a little bit. I won't say they accepted what happened, but they tolerated it and they made excuses for it. And it's okay, well, you know, oh, Stefan won the Giro in these circumstances, but he also went on then to win the Tour and Vicentini wouldn't have won the Tour. So that kind of put it a little bit into perspective and made him tolerate a little bit more what happened. But I think it's like what I love about the Italians is, and even when they talk bad about it, it's a passion that comes out in it. And you can always joke about it.
Did you actually feel in fear of your safety at any point during those days?
Definitely, and I wasn't the only one. I mean, everybody feared for my safety because they had my masseur was making my food for me because they were afraid of somebody trying to poison me. My mechanic was exclusively giving my bike to take care of because they were afraid of somebody sabotaging my bike. You know, I was in seclusion for nearly 10 days. I couldn't eat with my teammates because they were afraid of me, someone, you know, hitting me going down to the corridor of the hotel or something. So it was a very, very lonely life for the final 10 days of the Tour. Well, not the final 10 days. The second and last day, things got better when they finally realised that Vicentini probably wasn't going on the Tour. All of a sudden, I kind of recovered my teammates because they automatically thought, well, okay, well, gee, if Stephen wins here and he decides not to share the prize money, what are we going to do? So there was one very, very last difficult day before the time trial. And all of a sudden, I found most of my teammates on that day.
And you had some defenders riding with you. You had Eddie Scheppers, you had Robert Miller, Phil Anderson, people like that who were, you know, riding with you and to some extent protecting you.
Well, like Eddie Scheppers was my teammate and he was riding with me all the time. And then, of course, Miller was there riding for Panasonic, but riding for a place on the podium also. But Robert was more or less a bit disgusted with the reaction of the Italian public and the journalists, the media. I wasn't saying he wrote to help me, but he was using I was using him as a shield because on some of the climbs, like I had Eddie on the right and Robert on the left, or vice versa, and they were making sure the crowds stayed a certain distance. So by doing that, so it did help me a lot, yeah.
You won the Tour de France, you won the Giro, you won the World Championships all in one year. With the way that cycling has become more specialised now, do you see that happening again? Do you see a rider capable of doing that again?
Oh gosh, no, it's too hard. No, definitely it's possible to do it again, yeah. Definitely it's possible. You know, I just don't shout about it because it's nice to be the only guy with Eddie Merckx to have won a triple, you know, in the same year. But it's definitely possible. But the problem is that even if kind of the strongest riders wins the Giro, wins the Tour, if you get a dead flat World Championships and the guy isn't a sprinter, it's going to be very complicated for him to win. And I find myself that in latter years the World Championships hasn't really been a great all-rounder circuit. It's been all more or less for a sprinter or a guy that rides well in the sprint. So where the World Championships that I won was a fairly hard one. So it was, I wouldn't say it was easy, but it was easier for a Tour rider or Tour winner to be able to be performant in the World Championships. But it's definitely doable again, definitely, yes. But one of the main problems is the pressure on the riders to go out and do a Giro. You got to do so many kind of miles and training and kind of training camps before it. Then you got to go into the Tour. And like we're riding at 100% every day, where today the riders are riding 110%. And that you pay someday. And also one other thing is also the World Championships are a month later nearly. So whereas when I did it, it was bump, 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 done. And they get your Giro, the Tour, then you got to wait 2 months nearly before getting to the World Championships. So it's very complicated to kind of hold form or lose form and get it back again. But you have to kind of compete between the Tour and the Worlds to stay in condition. And so it makes it more difficult having the different, having more time between the two events to get a win.
Who's your tip for the Giro this year?
Well, let's see who rides it. First of all, I think Nibali is riding it, but Nibali it will be, of course, the favourite. But because Nibali he's an Italian, he's a bit of a moaner, and he even though he won his Tour, he's won a Giro, he's won a Vuelta, he's got an incredible list of wins behind him. But he navigates quite well. And going to the Giro this year with some of the big hitters concentrating on the Tour, he's my favourite.
You're off now to give some advice to riders who are taking part in the London Cycle Sportive, which takes place at the end of June this year. Finishes actually here at Herne Hill Velodrome, where we're speaking. Did you know that Fausto Coppi rode here in 1958 and in 1959 as well?
Actually? No, I didn't actually. I was only born in 59 as well. So, but nevertheless, it's like I've always heard about Herne Hill. Like even though living in Dublin in my upcoming years and getting into cycling, I mean, Herne Hill is a monument in cycling. And, I think for the sportive cyclists finishing here in June on the event, it's definitely going to be, an incredible feeling if they can look into the history of Herne Hill, and the old history, the Olympics, Coppi, Wiggins. I think it's, it's like going in and playing in Man United or your favourite football team's pitch. Here we are going to arrive in here into Herne Hill, where all these kind of legends have gone before, and closed for you. And also there's a possibility of even having a chip and getting your time on it, and doing a personal best. So just don't compare it to Wiggins or
Coppi,
yeah.
Thank you so much for being our guest. Before you go, can we just ask you to have a look through the Giro edition and see if you can pick out a picture that you particularly like the look of?
Certainly. Well, one thing, like we're now in 2016, and you look at the photographs here of the Campagnolo equipment, and you kind of say, it looks, quite ridiculous, ridiculously beautiful at the time. But at the time was also the way to go, drilling out your brake levers, drilling out your rear mag, drilling out your chain rings, dipping a drill into the brakes to take a little bit of aluminium out of it, And when you see the equipment we have today, which is no drilling, and it's much, 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 much lighter than... much more costly as well, of course, but much more lighter than those things, And this is something you think, that your grandfather would have done maybe, but in actual fact, we did it ourselves.
Did you actually do that? Because it always struck me as a very sort of English time trialing thing to do, but you actually did it as well.
I wasn't very far away in Dublin, and of course, our the habits we got it from a lot of from the UK, I always remember my dad comparing like Beryl Burton's bike and everything else. And I mean, we did, we'd no real information on what was going on in the rest of Europe when I was coming up in Ireland, but we had a lot of information on what was going on in the UK. So we would have probably copied or followed the fashion here in the UK. But and it was definitely a time trialing thing, yes, but then it became a mountain climbers thing as well. Then it became, why can't we use it all the time? And when you had a campag group set or a whatever group set we had, and there's some fabulous, looked really, really fabulous when it was drilled out, where sometimes it looked a bit bulky when it was normal. But definitely when you see the difference, that the group set there is probably around 1975, thereabouts, I suppose, late 70s, as I say, but which isn't that far away, really, yeah. When you see the way it's come on today.
And you did it yourself, you actually?
I did it all myself. I was a maintenance fitter, so I worked in a dairy and in a machine shop. And I used to drill out wherever I could. And sometimes a bit risky by times, I suppose. Looking back at it now, at the time it didn't seem dangerous, but looking back at it now, you say, well, wasn't lucky that nothing snapped, The bike got lighter, okay, but could have all gone wrong as well,
Yeah. Well, I'm glad it didn't. Stephen Roach, a pleasure to have you on the Ruler podcast.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thanks again to our special guest, Stephen Roach. All that remains, I think, Ian, is for the competition. And last time, there was a Flanders theme question in podcast 61.
There was. And the question at the time, I stress, was there have been two British winners of the Tour of Flanders, one man and one woman. Name them. It has, of course, since then changed because Lizzie Armistead did the business. But at the time, the winners were Tom Simpson, of course, and Nicole Cook. And the competition was won by Peter Ginman, who gets a lovely print of Simon Scarsbrook's illustration from issue 61 of the Flanders 100.
So congratulations to Peter Ginman. Our Giro-themed question for this edition is, in what year did the Giro cross the Grand Canal on a temporary bridge and then finish in San Marco Square? In what year did the Giro cross the Grand Canal on a temporary bridge and finish in San Marco Square? And the appropriate prizes are a Marco Pantani mug by Richard Mitchelson and a Demarchi cap. So go to the Ruler website, click on the podcast page. The question and details of how to enter are there. That's it from this Giro-themed edition. Thanks to our guest Stephen Roche. Thanks to Ian Cleverley. Thanks for listening. Join us next time. Until then, be careful out there.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.